This work is about the emerging threats in metro area wireless networks. So on one hand, we have the increasing wireless penetration. We have cities with hundreds of thousands of access points. And these days, almost every laptop comes with built-in Wi-Fi. On the other hand, we have intense efforts to increase the internet security. So what may happen is that attackers may be tempted to shift their attention to wireless networks, where the defenses are much weaker, and there are plenty of victims. In this work, we try to explore whether attackers could carry out large-scale opportunistic attacks over wireless, similar to those currently carried over the internet. There are several misconceptions about wireless security. For example, many users believe that it's not terribly bad to leave their access points open. But we know that many network protocols are vulnerable to attacks from users within the same access point. And also, attackers don't have to drive all the way to your parking lot to launch a Wi-Fi attack on you. Because we live in the age of botnets, all it takes to launch a Wi-Fi attack is a nearby zombie with a wireless. And self-propagating attacks are possible too. Another misconception is that the problem of wireless security is solved because now, after some few false starts, we finally have the proper crypto. But even WPA, the state-of-the-art crypto protocol for wireless, is vulnerable if it's used with a weak passphrase. And users also have understandable reasons to leave their access points open, such as convenience. Hotspots and public Wi-Fi tend to be open too. This clearly demonstrates that crypto still has lots of usability and maintenance issues. The implication is that lots of useful security remains unused. In many cities, up to 40% of the access points are actually open. In this talk, we focus on three threats specific to metro area wireless networks. Wildfire worms, which spread entirely over wireless. Attackers amplify botnets using large-scale wireless spoofing. And unauthorized location tracking systems we call tracknets. We focus on threat analysis, and we aim for defenses that are transparent for the users and network side, so they can be used even with open Wi-Fi. We start with wildfire worms. We call them like this because they spread by infecting nearby users, which in turn will infect other nearby users. This spreads much like a wildfire in a city. Let's illustrate this with a picture. So in this case, the infection will start from node number one. First of all, node number one will scan its own access point for vulnerable hosts and try to infect them. But the infection will not stop there. The infected nodes will scan for nearby access points and try to associate with them to infect hosts in there too. In this case, we can see that node number three is within range of another access point too. So it will associate with it if it's open and will infect hosts in there too. Those hosts will also try to search for nearby access points. And this way, the epidemic will spread like a wildfire. So how exposed are we actually to wildfire worms? Unlike internet worms, which can find and infect even very small vulnerable populations, thanks to global internet connectivity, this was exemplified by the Witty worm, for example, wildfire worms require pervasive vulnerabilities. Because in order to spread from a node, the wildfire worm must be able to infect at least one of the immediate neighboring nodes. Another interesting point is that wildfire worms can use both push and pull exploits. Push exploits require the victim running a vulnerable service. The wildfire worm will connect to the vulnerable service and send an attack. This is the same as with internet worms, such as a blaster. Pull exploits require the victim running a vulnerable client application. This could be a web browser. These kind of exploits are today used by malicious websites and email worms, and they require the victim to be tricked into either visiting a malicious website or opening a malicious email attachment. But wildfire worms can actually inject attacks into legitimate connections. So a user could get infected even if he's visiting a legitimate website, such as a CNN.com. In this figure, we see the exposure of Windows XP over a period of 28 months. And we can observe that there are certainly pervasive vulnerabilities that can be used for a wildfire worm. 50% of the time, there was a vulnerability that could be used. But what is interesting to point is that while push vulnerabilities are available about 10% of the time, pull vulnerabilities are available almost 50% of the time. There are many more vulnerabilities in browsers than in services currently. So this means that it's a very big advantage to be able to use this kind of vulnerabilities more actively in the way wildfire worms do. Another interesting question is, what is the effect of user mobility on the spread of a wildfire worm? As a user moves his laptop from his home to his work, he can carry the infection into isolated networks and carry it over areas without enough access points to support the spread of the wildfire worm otherwise. But the ground speed of the wildfire worm is very fast, and user mobility acts on a different time scale. So while user mobility is important for carrying the infection further, it doesn't affect much the speed of the worm, of the wildfire worm. Also, there is a lack of good models for user mobility and data, so we didn't explore this into a great depth. But even without user mobility, it would be interesting to know how far could a wildfire worm spread? How many hosts would get infected? Is it really a threat? And how fast can it spread? This is important for establishing response time requirements, for example. We ran simulations for 9 US cities and Singapore using access point locations collected by word driving efforts such as the WiggleNet projects and our own in the case of Singapore. We only used in the simulations the open access points, not those that use WPA or WEP. But in addition to access points locations, to run a simulation for a wildfire worm, we also need the location of the hosts, which are not available in public word driving maps. So we had to randomly populate the maps, roughly placing one host every 2 access points, which is the density we measured in Singapore. We ran several simulations, starting the infection in an area with lots of access points. And in this figure, we can see the percentage of infected hosts in each city as a function of time. We observe that in cities with many access points, dense access points, such as Chicago and New York, the worm can reach, can infect more than 80% of the machines in less than 20 minutes. In absolute numbers, this corresponds to between 20 and 40,000 machines in each city. And even in other cities, such as the Bay Area, where the infection stays is limited to 30%, because there are not enough access points to provide connectivity for the whole area, still the absolute numbers are very big. There are more than 10,000 for Bay Area, and there are also more than 10,000 for Seattle and San Francisco too. So we observe that the threat is real. Many machines can be infected this way, and also wildfire worms can be very fast, so responses have to be timely. But how can we defend against this kind of worm? We retrofitted state-of-the-art internet defenses, such as signature-based filtering and automatic signature generation for zero-day attacks and the honeypot sensors to wireless gear using the Linksys access point. Now we're going to move into another attack that's enabled by dense Wi-Fi in big cities, and that is botnet amplification using large-scale wireless spoofing. For example, instead of just spying on the local user, a zombie with wireless could redirect many nearby users to fake banking sites or even inject spam into their web requests, into their web pages. And this is possible because in many wireless networks, it's easy to sniff traffic, spoof packets, and hijack legitimate connections. A very easy attack is DNS spoofing, where the attacker sniffs a DNS request and sends a fake reply faster than the legitimate DNS server. The victim will use the IP address in the fake reply and will be redirected to a malicious site. Now, these attacks have been known for ages, since the times of shared Ethernet. But in this work, we re-examine them in the context of metro area wireless networks. And other protocols are vulnerable too. ARP spoofing is a particularly nasty case. In this plot, we see that usually about 90% of the users can access more than one neighboring access point. And 10 to 80% of the users, depending on the city, can access more than 10 neighboring access points. This makes them very useful for attacks like this. So how can we defend against wireless spoofing like this? Our first defense relies on the fact that normally all traffic in a wireless LAN is relayed over the access point. But for example, in the case of a fake DNS reply, it will appear to come from an external IP address because it claims to come from the wired side. But it will be received by the access point on the wireless interface. So our access point can detect packets like this, with inconsistencies like this, and drop them. But the attacker can elaborate his attack by using an external collaborator. Instead of sending the fake packet from within the network, the wireless network, he can instead notify an external collaborator who can send the packet from the wired side. Now the access point is not able to distinguish between these fake replies and the legitimate replies. And source address spoofing is quite prevalent still on the internet. But there is a solution that we can try to prevent the external collaborator from being able to send a fake reply. The basic idea is that we can map a sensitive identifier, such as DNS IDs or TCP sequence numbers, to another space. Obviously, some constraints have to be maintained. For example, sequence numbers have to be increasing. What we do is, for each flow, generate a random number, which is added to identifiers in one direction and subtracted from identifiers coming back in the other direction. Now the attacker cannot send the fake reply because he doesn't know the mapping to map the ID sniffed on the inside to a valid identifier that can be used to send the packet from the outside. But these defenses, as I mentioned, rely on the fact that normally all traffic is relayed over the access point. If the attacker could bypass the access point entirely, he could break these defenses. This may require hacked drivers and firmware updates, but it is possible, and actually proof-of-concept tools for this exist. Now the access point cannot enforce the filtering, but if it can still observe the attacker's packets, it can react to the attack and terminate affected connections, like later TCP connections. For the case of DNS, our access point will try to detect the case of more DNS replies than requests. And in that case, we'll check whether the excess replies are consistent between them. If they are not consistent, we'll terminate the connections. We evaluated this with several million DNS requests, and we had very few false positives. But even this attack relies at least on the access point being able to hear the attacker's messages. Modern chipsets allow power management, and the attacker could tune his power, depending on his position too, so that only the victim can listen to his attack packets. We call this a whisper attack. In this case, the previous defenses won't see any extra DNS replies. But we can still defend against these attacks by observing inconsistencies in the client's behavior alone. For example, in the case of HTTP traffic, our access point will try to find HTTP requests where the IP address of the server in the IP header and the hostname in the HTTP hostname header do not match the corresponding DNS reply. So we do some kind of consistency check across network layers. But this only works for HTTP, because for HTTPS, we're not able to inspect packet contents. So to summarize these attacks and defenses, some of the attacks we described are easier to orchestrate, and some of the defenses are more robust or more timely. Fortunately, there are robust defenses for the easy attacks. Now we'll move on to a different attack that is enabled by dense Wi-Fi in metropolitan areas, and that is malicious location tracking systems. The basic idea is that any attacker could rent Wi-Fi enabled zombies in a city and use them to monitor users, the location of users within range, without having to deploy his own infrastructure. The locations of the zombies can be easily determined by checking what other access points are within range and using public world driving maps. And the attacker could use MAC addresses to identify users, which are exposed even in protected networks. In this plot, we can see that if the attacker controlled 1% of the hosts, he could monitor 5 to 10% of all access points. This 1% in most cities corresponds to about 1,000 bots. If he controlled 5% of hosts, he could monitor from 20 to 80% of all access points. But even if the MAC addresses were obfuscated, the attacker could use the client's traffic to identify them. He could sniff cookies, or he could, for example, use the fact that many users are subscribed to RSS feeds, and the feeds to which they are subscribed can be used to identify them. These are retrieved periodically, and in this figure we see that they're very useful to distinguish users. So we conclude our discussion of large-scale Wi-Fi threads. In this work, we try to answer the question whether large-scale opportunistic attacks are possible today, and whether they're actually useful for the attackers. And we confirm that they are useful and they are possible, because bot populations can amplify Wi-Fi attacks by removing the requirement of the attacker being near the victim. These Wi-Fi attacks are no longer parking lot attacks. Also, metro area Wi-Fi amplifies bot capabilities. You can do more with less bots. We discussed some preliminary countermeasures. In the case of wildfire worms, we tried to retrofit wire defenses to wireless gear. In the case of wireless spoofing, we studied some defenses that can be used with open Wi-Fi and can detect different kinds of attacks. We saw that the attacker can easily elaborate his attacks, so some naive defenses may not be worth deploying. And we learned some lessons. First of all, we need to re-examine wireless security under the modern threat models. For example, we have to think about not just malicious users, but subverted users which can be in range. And we have to think not just about targeted attacks, we also have to think about opportunistic attacks. These kinds of attacks are exploited currently on the internet most. We also, as usual, we saw that the cause of the problems are non-technical constraints. The security is there. But if the users use weak passwords or even don't enable security at all, the problem persists. Thank you for your attention.
Hi, actually two questions. One more specific, when you were showing the numbers for that wildfire worm.
Yes.
The spreading times, were you actually assuming that there was a push or a pull of vulnerability?
Yeah, these times assume a push vulnerability. We actually created a prototype wildfire worm with a push vulnerability, and we could measure the time it takes to spread from one access point to another access point, and we could make very accurate estimations.
Okay, but so.
But for the pool worm, we have some simulations, and the order of magnitude is it takes around 10 to 20 hours for the same spread, for actually less spread because the range is also smaller. You can't go through the access point. But it's difficult to quantify precisely because we need to have some measure of how much time does it take for a user to make a legitimate web request.
Exactly. So that was basically the point. Like, that seems to be a very optimistic model from the point of view of the attacker, right? Because you assume basically instantaneous infection through a push vulnerability.
Almost instantaneous, 5 to 10 seconds.
Yeah. Okay, and maybe everybody's using the same Windows that is vulnerable and...
Yes, because practically almost everybody is using Windows. So that's why we had the slide with Windows vulnerability. This is well known, but it is a difference from internet worms. So it could be the case that they could not spread at all, but it's not the case. Still in the future, we have even denser wireless populations in cities. So I think that this attack can only get worse if we ignore it.
Okay. May I follow up? Or you want... Okay. Like a more general question, just like, you know, to hear your idea, if I find a pervasive push vulnerability, would you just, you know, use a wildfire worm or just use a regular worm? Because it seems that the wildfire worms would work pretty well for pool because then you're really, you know, in the same network as the guys and you could just fake their DNS and that would work really nicely. But if I have a push vulnerability, I might just, you know, spread really fast.
Yeah, it's interesting that maybe wildfire worms have even advantages over internet worms. We're not really sure about this, but consider, for example, a wildfire worm will not touch any of the ISP's equipment. So any of the defenses possibly deployed by an ISP, such as filtering firewalls or worm detection systems, most of the stuff that has been proposed for internet worms will not detect such a worm. So maybe if internet defenses get tough enough, which is certainly not the case now, maybe then attackers will actually feel tempted to attack the wireless networks.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
I also have a question about the mobility. So potentially I could have like a car or something that moves very fast and have some sort of a vulnerability which I can spread by just moving around and connecting very fast to access points and spread and connecting to one of the hosts, infecting it, and then the host will make sure that the rest of the people around there will be infected.
Would you be an attacker driving in the car?
Yes, or? I will be an attacker driving in the car.
Yeah, the thing is that you don't even have to drive your car. You can stay hidden somewhere, launch the attack from internet on one host, and don't even visit the city.
The question is, will that make my attack faster?
Seeding a large number of initial hosts with the worm certainly makes the attack start faster, because some initial attempts may fail if there are, for example, not enough victims in the area. So a reasonable attacker would probably start the infection anyway in several hundreds or tens of hosts. So it would help.
So,
but you don't have to drive around the entire city. That's the essence of the self-propagation in the attack.
So what about also using a mixed mode, where I have some knowledge in the internet and some knowledge on the host, so like I can exchange potentially controlled data from the internet and have the actual attack propagate through the wireless interface.
But then it's Christopher's point that why would you use wireless at all? Maybe a reason to use wireless is to avoid using the internet.
Yes.
But you could have some small communication which can be hidden.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Like you can have a small portion of the communication that goes like stealthy below radar.
Well, there are lots of improvements you can do as an attacker on this work. You could use fake access points, several kinds of different attack vectors, and you can take it from here and make something very bad. You're just trying to point out that the threat is already there. So maybe we should start thinking about defenses, or maybe start thinking about protecting our access points. Thank you.
So I used to have 5 neighbors with open networks, and I only have 1 nowadays. And it seems like even if the density of networks is increasing, the density of open networks might be reducing. Do you expect this trend to affect these results?
Ideally, if there were no open access points, it would be much safer against these kind of attacks. If you check out war driving maps, still there are lots of open access points. Before some years there are even more, but still there are up to 40% in many cities. So there is some persistent reason that makes the users leave their access points open. I even find myself using open access points because of the inconvenience of having to configure a password and then forget about it. Any other questions?
So in our environment and also many of the modern access points, they provide a feature like client separation. So basically, once you join the access point, you have, you're basically on your own VLAN. You cannot reach the other clients that are connected to your access point. Doesn't this defeat the whole wildfire?
There are two points about this. First of all, if you use some attacks that bypass the access point entirely, then you can also bypass isolation, because this isolation is enforced by the access point. It just doesn't relay packets from one client to the other. The other point is that as we have more and more wireless networks deployed, for example, in a city, like a network that covers the whole city, you will want to have communication between the clients. So this is very good in a setting in your organization, but maybe it's not appropriate for citywide wireless efforts. So it is a solution, but may not be usable, or may not want to use it.
I was wondering what you think about DNSSEC, and you know, if we actually had deployment of DNSSEC and clients were using it, and you combine that with more use of HTTPS, how that would sort of help against the phishing and farming problems?
It would certainly make things much more secure. The problem is that we're waiting for DNSSEC to be deployed for ages, and currently it's not deployed. There are also other attacks, not just DNSSEC. But certainly having DNSSEC rolled out would improve the situation by a lot.
Thank you.
I think that there's something very useful and open about the idea of having cities that have open access points all over that anyone can use without having to, you know, gain permission from various people and having this open environment. I mean, there's something very attractive about that. I mean, is there any way to salvage that aspect of things without, you know, completely being...
Certainly. That is one of the main points of our work, because we try to make defenses that can be used with open Wi-Fi. So you don't have to... Of course, if you close your network, you're protected to a certain extent. But this kind of reactive and filtering defenses that I presented work even if you leave your wireless open and let anybody connect. Because it's such a waste of equipment. We have already very big coverage in the cities. Why not use it? Thank you.
Let's thank the speaker.
Thank you.